Our agenda is in IRC. Today we have to finish reviewing the algorithm specifications, the algorithm spec updates by the editors of issue 218. Then we need to talk about this inverse feature, issue 221. Issue 223 is what we're going to do about base versus at base, the keyword, so the option to the API call versus the at base keyword. And then issue 222 is a comment about JSON-LD not aligning as closely as someone would have liked to for it to align with RDF syntax. So let's go ahead and get started. Are there any updates or changes to the agenda? Okay, let's start going through issue 218 and pick up where we left off last time, which was all the way down on towards 510, the compassion algorithm. So let's try and do what we did last week. Marcus, if you don't mind pointing out the things you feel need to be discussed, and then Dave Longley, if you don't mind responding. We'll try to get through these quicker than we did last week.
Should we really do this on the call? I'm not so sure if it's really productive.
Well, I feel like we need to, I mean, it's either we need to discuss these things and get them done and out there, because this is one of the major blockers for the API spec, or we need to discuss them offline, but looking at our history of discussing things offline, we tend to not do it until the next call. So if we can do this in some other way, that would be great, but we need something like that on the table, another option of addressing all these issues.
Could we defer it? I mean, how long... How much is left, do you think? Will this take up the most part of the telecom?
There doesn't seem to be that much left, meaning like most of the remaining checkboxes are checked. So it seems like we should be able to get through this in about 30 minutes. We can.
Let's cut off time at 7:30, say.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Okay, so let's get through as much of this as we can. Marcus?
Okay, so you said 510, right?
Yeah, 510 compaction algorithm, step 2.2.
Okay, so the question there is, I think, I haven't looked at the algorithms the last week, so maybe that was changed, but I don't think so.
I don't think it's been changed.
The question in that comment was whether we really need to explain how a shallow copy is created, because it's described in quite a detailed way. And I think the point is just that since properties could be added or deleted, that shouldn't happen. So therefore, we need to create a shallow copy so the values are still references, but the properties itself have to be copied of the main object, so to speak. So the question there was really just if we need to explain it in that detailed manner, or if we can just say, well, we create a shallow copy.
Well, my concern with only saying we create a shallow copy is that people might implement that incorrectly. If you read shallow copy just as a without any knowledge about what you're doing, you would actually do the wrong thing. Because in this case, you need to create a shallow copy of the object. You can't just copy the properties and then use references to the arrays for each property. You have to actually create new arrays for each property as well, and then use the references to the values in those arrays. So it's actually a two-level deep shallow copy, which is why there's the extra explanation. If we want to simplify that explanation in some way, that's fine. But I don't think we should just say make a shallow copy, because people will inevitably do the wrong thing.
Well, the tests are there to help them find if they do, of course. But I think perhaps just saying make a two-level shallow copy would be adequate without having to go into a
If people agree that is sufficient, that's fine. We can do that.
I don't think that's sufficient. I think it's very vague what that means.
I mean,
if you say two-level shallow copy, that raises more questions in my mind than just having the spec text there saying what's going to happen. Sorry, go ahead, Marcus.
The thing is also, arrays, I think in most languages, they would be copied in a shallow copy. That's not that they would stay references.
I disagree. I think pretty much every language except for PHP does that.
Depends on the language, yeah. But
I think the common case in programming languages is to do the opposite of what PHP does.
And I think
it's the first level of the array. So that's where the shallow copy is created, isn't it?
Yeah, but in most languages, when you create the shallow copy, the only thing that would be shallow copied are the properties. The keys would be shallow copied, and then the arrays would be passed linked up by reference, and that would do the wrong thing because the arrays are what are going to be modified when you remove values.
Yeah, you're correct. Sorry. Yeah.
I think the fact that we're discussing this so much is a fairly decent indicator that we should have this text in there.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay. Well, that means we can just check the box, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just checked it.
Okay. So the rest of 5.10 seems to be addressed. 5.12 is up next, the inverse context creation subalgorithm.
Yeah, that is a similar point. Then in the inverse context creation subalgorithm, in some steps, it said initialize some variable to the value associated with the key of some map. So the value of a key in a map. So for example, if you have the inverse context, we have that Bible language map there. So you have add type, and the value is the IRI of the type you're looking for, and the value of that is another object. And what you want to do in that step is to create a pointer to that map. And initializing it to the value associated with that key, it's at least I wouldn't understand that should be a pointer. And the reason why that's important is because that pointer is then used to modify that referenced map. And I think we should be a bit more explicit that we do mean a pointer there. It's not that you copy it or something. So in this case, it's not a shallow copy, for example.
So in this situation, we have a couple of different factors that might cause us some consternation. So this effectively, this happens throughout the spec in a few places where we want to create a temporary variable to make the explanation of the algorithm easier, and so we don't have to repeat ourselves so much. Now,
that's true, but normally it's not about writing to that temporary variable, but reading from it.
Okay. Well, what I was going to say is we also have this other issue where Greg would like the algorithms to sort of be described mathematically, and if you look at it from that point of view, maybe if you don't explicitly say copy, then you shouldn't be meaning copy. But I understand that if other people are going to read it and get confused, that perhaps we need to change the language in some way. I'm just not sure what language we want to use, because it might be strange to say, maybe it wouldn't be, but it might also be strange to say, set it to a reference of a member, because it seems like we're starting to get into more programming terms than just a mathematical description of what's going on, but I'm not sure. Maybe Greg has an opinion.
Especially the term value in there is confusing, because values are normally copied by copied and not like
the name or object. Yeah, I agree with that.
Maybe it's just the name of the variable.
which name?
Well, initialize variable to the name associated with key. So it sounds like then variable, well, I don't know.
I mean, could we could take out to the value associated with. We could say initialize variable to the key in map or something.
Well, it's not the key, though. So you're not copy. You're not referencing
well, yeah,
the key.
Yeah.
You're referencing
right.
the
yeah.
value of key.
Right.
So I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it would be enough to say initialize variable to a reference or set variable to a reference of the value,
value of
yeah,
key.
Et cetera.
If people don't have any problem with that language, it's fine with me. I was worried that there would be an issue because it seems like it's bringing in programming terms into the mathematical algorithm.
Well, saying mathematical, I wasn't really pushing for pure mathematics. I was just looking for something that's more algorithmic. We are referencing data structures, JSON data structures in particular, and I think we need to be able to use the terminology that's commonly used, or at least that seems to make sense when discussing those types of data structures. So in this case, you have keys and values, and what you want is a reference to the value associated with that key. Maybe that's the way to say it.
Well, there are two other ways that just I thought of. We could say reference the value of the key in the map using the name of the variable, or we could say let this variable identify the value in the key in the map. If we said it like that, then maybe that would be clearer.
Yeah, I think either of those would be fine.
Can you type that down so that we have it?
Yeah, Greg,
I just did.
Great.
I think I'd prefer the first one versus the second one.
Reference
the value
of
the key in the map.
And
yeah,
where,
I think so.
Where's the name of the variable in that reference value?
Well, we could say let. Yeah.
There, I typed something in RC.
There you go.
Yeah, makes sense.
Okay.
Okay, so next up is step 336.
336, that's purely editorial, I would say. The thing is that those checks there, they are always kind of negative checks. So there is like, if there is no type mapping, do that. If there is no language mapping, do that. I think it would be easier to say if there is a type mapping and otherwise if there is a language mapping instead of saying...
Yeah, as long as that doesn't change any shortcutting in the algorithm or short-circuiting in the algorithm, that's fine. Go ahead and make those changes. If it doesn't, you know, add anything or if it's just purely editorial, that's totally fine.
I'm fine with that too.
Okay. Then... Right. Term selection subalgorithm. Yeah, this is the question. Here is where the duplicates, which are produced by a property generator, are checked. So where it is checked, if those duplicates exist or not. Should that be done in term selection, which means that they are also deleted there directly during term selection, or should that be done? Sorry, yeah.
Sorry, Marcus, I lost you. We were on step 336 of 512. Where are we now? 511 IRI compaction algorithm, first item.
Did I skip something? Sorry. Oh yeah.
No, we didn't skip anything. Yeah, we moved on to 511. the 336 mono. Oh, okay. Well,
right. I'm saying
it's about the same point. Yeah. So it's IRI compaction or term selection subalgorithm. The first points are talking about the same thing, so it doesn't matter where we are.
Okay. So this is about dropping the parent parameter.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that parent parameter is also in term selection subalgorithm, which is 513,
okay.
The first point.
Yes, so the reason why that exists is that you don't want to remove anything from the object until you're sure that you actually match the object. If you don't match it, then you'll end up removing duplicates, and then you'll find out later that you didn't match, and then you made a bunch of edits to something you shouldn't have made edits to.
Yeah, that's true. The question is whether you remove those duplicates in term selection, which you could otherwise also use differently, or whether you do that in the inside of the compaction algorithm itself. So currently it's done during term selection. So term selection is not only looking for a term or potential property generators, but it also modifies the data by removing those duplicates. My opinion would be that it's cleaner to keep term selection and IRI compaction so that they only return data but they never modify any data, and then those potential property generators are checked in the compaction algorithm. So it basically loops through all the potential property generators, and the first one where all the duplicates are found, that's the one that is being picked and the duplicates are being removed. Otherwise, it falls back to the term.
Hang on. I'm taking a look at the implementation I have that I base the algorithm off of does not actually remove anything during term selection. Let me double check that the spec text actually say to remove during term selection?
I'm not sure. I thought it was done there.
No, I'm taking a look at it right now. There's a flag for the find property generator duplicates algorithm. There's a flag for removing things, and it's set to false when you're doing term selection. So term selection doesn't actually remove anything. It just checks the parent to make sure that the term will match and then returns the term. And then the actual removal happens during compaction. So it does already do what you're suggesting.
So it loops over the whole subtrees twice, then.
Yes.
So my suggestion would be to not pass any data to the term selection, but just to return the candidates, so to speak, and do that checking in IRI compaction. That's the only place where it's done. So the change
your suggestion is the.
Sorry.
I was going to say you would prefer the term selection algorithm to return back possible terms that you could use, not the actual term.
Yes.
So if there are multiple
terms, and that's only the case if there are property generators. If there are property generators, you get back the potential property generators and a fallback term or IRI. And then
I understand it's less algorithmically complex to do it that way, but it kind of hurts my brain a little to think that the term selection is not going to return back the term you want to use. So you call the term selection algorithm and then you get back a list of terms for you to do the selection from. If in the case of property generators. I realize it would be an optimization to do it differently, and maybe people should implement it that way if they want to, but I don't know if that's the best way to describe it in our algorithms.
Yeah, it seems to me that the term selection algorithm should give you back a term, right?
Well, but the key there is that in property generators, you don't know which term it is till you check all the data. And that's why property generators are so complex.
Yeah, but if you pass the term selection algorithm, the parent, then it will make the determination for you and give you back the right term.
Yeah. But basically, you have to do the same work twice then.
Well, for explanation purposes, it's simpler to say that the term selection algorithm always gives you back the term.
If we were to drop property generators, would this problem go away?
Yeah, then everything would be much
simpler. That's an interesting
much
solution.
Greg.
Well, I mean, we have talked about putting it at risk, and I think if we put it at risk, there's a strong likelihood that it would just not, that it would go away. In which case, maybe spending too much time on optimizing for it is wasted time.
That's a good point. I think the other thing, though, is that I'm very wary of putting the feature at risk just because we've done all the work for it and Lynn and Drupal seem to have a use case for it. But Stefan as well, so it's not just Drupal. So
I don't buy that. It seems to me if it's not necessary, the amount of work we've done on it is immaterial. We could always move it into a note that would allow it to be extended. I don't see any likelihood that Lynn is going to come back to this in the future.
I'm not just talking about Lynn. I'm talking about the general ability to list multiple properties like we do in RDFA and have all of those expressed. You see what I'm saying?
You can do that explicitly.
Yeah.
You really need to do that.
Okay. Well, we're getting a little off.
I mean,
there's still
a lot of unexpected behavior that happens if you do the wrong thing with property generators as well.
I think they are just really, really complex, and they have some non-obvious effects. So this is not RDFA. We don't really have the same ability to do things, and we don't have the same requirements. RDFA has no round tripping requirements, so it seems to me that without someone that really is pushing for this, that we are a better specification without it.
Yeah, the amount of work we've put into it so far is an indication of how complex it is.
Yeah, I completely agree. And if you're going to implement those algorithms, you wouldn't understand what's going on in there. I'm quite sure.
Yeah, and I mean, JSON-LD has a rumor of being very complex as it is, and I think that seeing property generators in it is one of those troublesome aspects, I fear. I think that it's clearer to duplicate that data. And as Greg said, it's RDFA has a very different usage.
Okay, well, it sounds like we have consensus to remove it, or at the very least mark it as at risk. But we're not talking about that right now, I don't think.
How much time should we spend talking about algorithm things that are going to be, say, marked at risk, if given that there are things that are not at risk that still need to be discussed?
I think the algorithm still needs to be, still need the correct text in there if we're going to, you know, take this to last call. And if the correct text is, let's just leave it as is, with the assumption that we're going to drop the feature and therefore parent's going to be dropped in the future, then we don't need to talk about it anymore, right?
Well, but it's not that simple. Basically, all the algorithms would change if we drop property generators, so that would mean that there would be definitely a second call. It's not an editorial change like removing a paragraph or something.
Yes, I think so.
So
So really, if we're going to drop it, I suppose the time to do it is before LC.
Yeah.
The problem is it's upon us. We need to get this document out, and it's going to be better to do this now, I think, but I don't know. Could we take would a week be enough time to have rewritten the algorithms to remove property generators?
Yes, if we have the time to do it. I mean,
well,
I
think it's probably
pulling them out isn't that bad.
Yeah,
I mean the algorithms don't change that much, other than
Greg, we're under a serious time crunch at our company anyway, so it's going to be very difficult to. I don't disagree with removing it. I guess now I don't disagree with removing it, but it's just that the timing for all of this is pretty awful. But I do agree with you that the time to do it would be before we go into last call. So I think what we're talking about is a delay of going into last call while some of the algorithms are rewritten to remove property generators. That is after asking Lynn and Stefan if it's okay if we remove it, because it is making everything really complicated.
Well, I mean, asking Lynn if it's okay, it's a bit a stretch, I would say.
Well, I mean, it would be good to know, you know, what she thinks. Like, if she...
Yeah.
I think she's moved on.
I didn't get that impression, but maybe that's true. Okay, so let's go back to discuss. Well, it's 10:30 now, so we're out of time for going through these. We've got six checkboxes left. Do we want to keep going, or do we want to switch to the other items in the agenda?
Well, I guess we can close this out. That'll be one thing less hanging over our heads. So if we can try to go through it quickly, maybe that would be worthwhile.
So what about just talking about those things that don't have to do anything with property generators?
That's fine.
Okay. So in term selection, sometimes at null is used and sometimes at known is used.
Is there a spot in this document? 513,
the
document?
513,
second checkbox.
I know that they've used that to differentiate whether something was explicitly set to null or if it wasn't set at all, but it doesn't make any difference. So the result wouldn't change, and I think it would be easier to just use at null for everything instead of having two different constants here.
I mean, if it's actually true that nothing changes, then we can clean that up. But I remember that there was a case either in my head or that I should have added a test case for where it mattered. Maybe it had something to do with default language. I don't remember.
Yeah, I mean, my algorithm is almost exactly the same as yours, and I just use that now. And I pass all the tests, and I couldn't think of a case where it would actually matter. The only thing you have to keep in mind
it might have actually mattered where...
That... So
it might have
you just
specifically indicated that there was, like, a switch or something.
Sorry,
if there were two terms there... If there were two terms to choose from, and one of the terms specifically indicated a null language, and the other one didn't, you needed to be able to differentiate between the two.
Yeah, that's the at null. That's what at null is for, to indicate that it was set to at null. If it wasn't set, you wouldn't have that at language entry anyway at all.
Yeah, you know what this might be? Is it might be that I simplified it so you didn't have to do existence checks all the time. You just did... It was simplified so that you just looked in the map because the entries were always there. And that's why I had null and none. we could change it so you have to check for existence of entries instead, because at this point it might be simpler from whatever the original implementation I was doing had in there. I'll go back and take a look at it when I get some time and clean it up.
Okay. Yeah, that comment is whether it's really good to have variables which are very similar, so type or language, type or language map, type or language value map, or whether we should have different names or concatenate the names. Like, we have those camel case names, and sometimes we append a map to it, which isn't
Didn't we discuss this last week? And my opinion was that the camel casing was just too language. It was taking sides in a religious battle that's really not necessary if the purpose is specifying a language where we can easily just say type or language as three words and designate them as being in code as being a single thing.
We did have that conversation, but this one is slightly different in that there are two issues here. One of them is, do we use camel case or not? And I think we've decided let's not do that. The other one is that we have a number of variables that have very similar names that could confuse people. So type or language.
And if you cut and paste the algorithms into plain text, it would be even more confusing because you would lose all of the markup that helps you differentiate the names.
Well, I mean, type or language value map, is that a different variable than type or language value? Or is it the type of language value map that where the variable name is type or language value?
The type or language.
Type or language. Oh, I see. All right. Well, but if you can count on the styling, that type or language value is styled as code. Or just, I think if we do pick something that is less similar, then it becomes less confusing. So if that's possible, then I think that's probably a better way to go. Map of type or language values.
Dave, to address your concern of what happens if somebody copies and pastes it into like a comment block in code, they should, when they do that copy and paste, put single quotes around the value to make sure that people understand.
I was just recalling. We had an email maybe from David Wood talking about how that happens quite a bit or might happen. And so he complained about it previously because of we actually had a bug in Respec that didn't capitalize text for normative language. But this could be a similar case that gets brought up by the same person or someone else. I just want to make sure that we're covering that.
Yeah, I think the response is, they should use single quotes.
Yeah, unfortunately, that requires that, when you do the copy-paste, you actually have to do that manually because it doesn't come out otherwise.
And the other alternative is that we change Respec to put single quotes around, TDEFs that are multi-word. Or whatever this, whatever the styling markup is that we use in Respec, we have it inject single quotes around the name.
It's inject single quotes and then hide them. That actually would be a sort of a cool little hack.
Yeah. In any case, I don't
use,
think that
in
we.
In which case, I'd use backticks because it works in Markdown.
There you go. Yeah, but I think that this is, if that's an issue, I think we can say we need to update Respec to do that, and then we're just not going to camel case this stuff. And we should use variable names that are different if we can. I mean, there's some cases where the language used is is the most accurate to describe the variable. I think this is really a judgment call for the editors that make the edit. We can bike shed this for a lot longer, but I don't think we should spend that time doing something else, not bike shedding this more. I think Marcus has a good point. So now that Marcus has a good point, it's up to the editors to try and address that.
I think that would be a generally useful thing to do in respec. It might have some odd implications because you can use code for longer examples as well, and quotes around them, but it's not.
Yeah,
long.
So I thought we were gonna change away from code to something more specific. Like a C-ref or something like that.
Well,
or V-ref.
I'm really not in favor of extending our extensions to respec when things are probably better done in respec. This is a generic problem that everyone's going to have. So coming up with a solution that could be incorporated into core would be much more broadly beneficial. And perpetuating the use of specific things like T-ref and T-def is, I think, an anti-pattern. So I would vote for, and I will actually look into support and respect to do this.
Okay. What's the next one?
Next one has to do with property generators, then it's value compaction. Preserve index, I have to look up what that meant.
Hey, I don't know that we're going to really get too far on that one on that call. I think it was just a style difference in opinion on what the style should be.
Okay.
The algorithm that I wrote kept track of whether or not you needed to preserve the index, and the older algorithm just copied the value and deleted the index whenever it decided to that it should be deleted. And so one does a modification, one does a copy, the other one doesn't do a copy, and doesn't change anything unless it needs to. And so we'll just have to figure that out. I haven't had time to go back and look at it and see if it... I didn't really think it was that complicated, but I'll have to look again.
Okay. Okay, then probably we shouldn't discuss value compaction at all here or now.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything to really discuss there right now.
Okay, so
let's
very quickly get some kind of resolution on property generators. So it sounded like there was consensus to remove property generators, and if we're going to remove property generators, it should be done before we go into last call. We should chat with Stefan and Lynn about the removal of this stuff and see what they have to say, but I think we should also make it clear that the group really would like to remove this feature because it adds so much complexity to the algorithms that it's and it causes so many things that are strange that are non-intuitive to happen when you use property generators that we may just want to just remove the feature entirely from JSON-LD.
Complexity and unexpected behavior.
Jason. Paul, you're up.
Regarding the property generators, how would this affect the actual RDF being being created? I mean, is this just a shortcut to not have to repeat yourself in the context? Because I see us having a significant use case to where we need to be able to assign multiple IDs to a single term going forward. For example, like when we're building out some of our ontologies and structures and such, to where we can merge them between like our internal structure, but also essentially doing like same as type relationships with things like schema.org and good relations.
It's more like same property. But not really. The original idea was to sort of be able to do what you can do in RDFA, where you can say add property and then list a set of things that expand to IRIs with a single value. And RDFA is really the only RDF variation that allows you to do that. There was need, the Drupal had a similar need where they were, say, using both schema.org and COOK or Dublin Core, and they didn't want to have to repeat properties. The problem is that JSON-LD requires round-tripping, which means that you can use that for expansion so that when you have such a term, it results in multiple expanded terms in the expanded form. But to round-trip, you need to be able to identify those and compact back, and that is what's been causing all the consternation.
Okay.
But at the same time, if Paul has a use case for this, we're talking about removing, you know, a feature that we now have, you know, three different people that have said that they have use cases for it.
Well the real complication is in compaction.
Potential.
I'm sorry.
Is he actually saying that he has a use case?
Say that again.
Are you actually saying that you have a use case for that? Because you were mentioning old.
Sounds like
Hello?
Someone's back. Yeah.
Yeah.
There we go.
What I was going to say was that we could consider relaxing the round-tripping rules and could keep property generators for sort of the ability to reduce the markup, but without the need to take that into effect when compacting. Because I think that's the real complexity is in compacting, not in the expansion.
Well, it's also labeling all blank nodes and stuff like that.
Yeah, true.
Well, I feel like if we do, did Paul ever, or was Paul ever able to say whether or not he had a use case?
I did not know. Hear it.
He did. I think he did feel he had one, where he was looking at a way to use the language to provide some same as or same property types of features.
His question was whether it changes something in the mapping to RDF, which it doesn't really, I think.
He's dialing back, it looks back in, so let's see.
Should we ping Lynn, because I see she's online as well?
Sure, go ahead, Marcus, if you can. It sounded like Paul's use case was similar to Lynn's in that they had one, they wanted to express one thing, but they wanted to express multiple IDs when it was converted to RDF.
Yeah, but I think Lynn really wanted be round-tripping the work. Maybe Paul doesn't need that.
No, I have... I mean, everything that we do now round-trips, right? So us making an exception for property generators is, I think, might cause more
property
problems
generators
than...
will often round-trip.
Sorry about that. I have no idea what happened to the...
I think it was a problem on our end. Everyone's connection got...
Yeah, everyone lost audio.
Oh, okay. So what was the last thing? Because I kind of went on a nice little monologue.
Well, I think that it would be good if you could do the monologue again, because we'd like to understand what your use case is and whether or not we could make some modifications to property generators to still address your use case, but maybe possibly to make them simpler.
Right. So, in the effectively, we're actually using the JSON LD, honestly, more like almost like a JSON RDF type structure. I don't know if I'm repeating what you already heard, but we are we're building out some ontologies that define our use cases, obviously, in our business domain, and then trying to tie those in with other existing ontologies, such as Dublin Core, in some cases, Good Relations, Schema.org, and others, in order to be able to allow our customers better access into our data. Part of that is, since we do have the, like, for example, let's take a very simple case that I've been, simple, address. I mean, we have our own internal address structure, which has some very distinct requirements, but it also has some things that are very common, obviously, like city, state, zip, or locality, and all that. We are putting in the same as or same property type relationships in our ontologies, which actually gets generated through into the code all around. So being able to say, hey, these three property or these three IRIs are term are the same, are effectively the same term.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, but you were doing it in a syntactic layer, sort of, rather than in an inference layer. You want your customers to be able to just directly access the property
right.
and such, rather than perform some, or use like a Sparkle inference.
Well, currently we push the stuff up, and then they can do Sparkle inference on the. Essentially, we're doing actually Sparkle inference on our client as well, with a client-side Sparkle engine. So we give some data, and then they infer and parse out what they need. It's kind of a strange use case, but it's getting around some technical hurdles that we have.
And do they ever need to write back to the data, or is it just read-only?
They will write back. Currently, it's just a REST-based type system, so we're not using Sparkle Update at this point. At some point, we probably will end up being trying to move all the Sparkle side stuff server side, at which point we'll require like full Sparkle client and server, which kind of gets back to the I don't know if we're abusing JSON LD by using it as a more of a general form of RDF, but that's kind of how we're using it.
Well, I think what you've shown is there's yet another use case that makes use of this, and as much as we might have to hold our nose about the complexities of implementing the feature, I think this would the support you're showing for it is enough to keep it in.
Okay. Yeah, and
one more question. Aren't you you said you are defining ontologies? So aren't you connecting those ontologies to other ontologies like DC, schema.org, etc.?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. So we are doing that on the ontology side. However, some of our clients don't actually necessarily know about the ontologies, because we're doing, there is some hand waving, to where we give them the pieces that they need to know, and kind of hide some of the actual links behind the scenes. Now, on the positive side, I mean, if it turns out that this is not like that, that the property generators is such a complex beast, we are actually early enough in our development cycle that we're not bound to this, as in we've spent a lot of development effort going down this path. We do have options. We're actually relatively early in the cycle, so we're still in that wiggle room area.
So the only change if we would drop property generators would be that if you convert the JSON-LD, or if you expand it or you convert it to RDF, you would have to have, for example, three properties for the three vocabularies you are using for the three ontologies, instead of having one which expands to all three IRIs.
Right. And where the question and the concern, I should say, that I've got is where you start having data duplication, and like when we are doing updates back, that it populates all of them, and to reduce the chance of user error and programmer error, in order to make sure that, you know, like I think in the example here, with the book, The Count of Monte Cristo, to where having like the three, like Title I, Title II, Title III, making sure that all of those get updated, as opposed to just being able to update one, and then have the system be able to know that, okay, well, hey, since this is property generated, I need to push these up.
Yeah, that's one of the problems with property generators, because if one of your clients is going to expand this stuff to the full IRIs and then just updates the one which he understands, it wouldn't compact back to the property generator. It would stay there as a full IRI, because the same data wouldn't be in all three IRIs. It can't compact them back.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my biggest concern with property generators, is that people might start thinking that they don't have to do extra work, and they're going to have to. If they do any updates, you have to update every single one of those properties if you want to compact back down.
If you use expansion. If the clients are working in the compacted form.
Well, yeah. And it certainly sounds like that's what the case is. It sounds like he's converting RDF. And
if you work with it as RDF and not as just syntactic JSON, this is duplication. It's just hidden in the compact form.
Right. And actually, we pass back the compacted form between client and server. At first, we were talking about doing it where we were going to pass back and forth, expand it, but we found some easier ways of handling using the letting the client do all the expansion and do with as it needed. But I mean, if as what you're saying, I mean, obviously, I mean, if I had the incorrect notion there, then maybe it is something that we need to take that needs to be taken out, just to make sure that we don't have misinterpretation or misthinking about what all the capabilities are, so that if without the property expansion, I mean, yeah, it's obvious, hey, you have to update these three things, as opposed to you have to update just one and it'll just happen. So
there are no flags, or there's no extra piece of information that gets exported in expanded form or in RDF that could tell a JSON-LD processor how to recompact that data. The only thing we use is that the values are duplicate. So if
the
you change just one, it wouldn't look like a duplicate anymore.
Yeah, so that actually sounds like a great reason in my mind to go ahead and get rid of property generators, just to protect people like myself from going down the wrong path.
It might be interesting for you to look at the sort of simplified form of full OWL reasoning, which we added in the RDFA syntax called vocabulary expansion. I just pasted the link, which is a way to do this driven by your own ontologies, where you use the subproperty or equivalent property semantics and use that mechanism to ensure that you can infer other properties.
Okay.
Upon usage.
I'll take a look at that offline, and just to make sure that, because I might I'll study that some. With my misunderstanding then of how they were used. I mean, if I've been looking at, while I'm no expert at all on this, I have been kind of in the JSON LD investigative mode since like last September, and been working on the linked data stuff for about a year. So, if I'm mistaken like that, other people will be. So at that point, I am starting to lean much more on the side of that, probably to protect people from themselves, that feature might need to be reevaluated, or at least be done at risk.
Well, that doesn't make it any easier.
In other words, I'm agreeing with you. I thought I had a disagreement, but
yeah,
y'all...
I guess the concern is that you have a use case here where we're potentially, you know, if we remove the feature and we're wrong, then there is no solution, no very easy solution to your use case. I mean, there is something like vocabulary expansion, and you know, there's reasoning that you could do, but those are even worse than accidentally shooting yourself in the foot with property generators.
True.
So it's
probably harder to find.
Mm-hmm. And you have to end up writing quite a bit of code, you know, on this to even get it working.
Currently, either way, your application is going to have to keep track of which properties all are supposed to work together. That's going to have to happen if you're going to do updates.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi, Lynn.
How are you doing? We're currently discussing whether or not we should remove property generators from the JSON-LD spec.
Right.
So we were wondering if you thought that they would be a future use for them, as defined right now. And I guess we're saying this from because we put a lot of work into it, but if no one's going to end up using the feature, then there's a lot of complexity to the feature, and it is making a lot of the algorithms fairly complicated.
Right. So at this point, I don't think that they're a requirement for us, because by switching to using HAL for the one use case, you know, we're really focusing our use of JSON-LD to aligning with external vocabularies. And although that, you know, people who are using JSON-LD will not necessarily be optimizing for, you know, smaller size documents. So I think that it should be okay from our standpoint.
Okay, so it would be okay if we remove the property generator feature from your standpoint.
Correct.
Okay. So what does the group think? I mean, we've heard from Lynn and we've heard from Paul. Paul seems to have a use case. But it seems like his use case, that the property generators don't fully solve his use case, and they kind of are not, they're not really a solution for his use case, because if he needs to modify the data, the wrong thing's going to happen with property generators as they're implemented right now. In Lynn's use case, it seems like they've found another solution, which is HAL, for the
at least the property generator portion of it. So at this point, I don't think we have anyone that's saying that they need property generators.
I think it's much easier to reintroduce them at a later point in time than to drop them later. Because
yes,
if they are in there once, we can't get rid of them anymore, basically. So.
Yeah.
And I think they border so much on the level of semantics that people who need the feature would be able to use something like vocabulary expansion. They can put the equivalent property information as data in their contexts, for instance. If they want to send the signal that there are equivalences here to the properties that we use, it's not syntactic and not part of JSON-LD, but it's still on the semantic level already defined mechanisms.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the only way their property generators are really going to work in the future, if we're going to allow data updates, is if we were to include something in expanded form that allowed us to recompact, that would be, you know, that would take care of it for JSON-LD, and if they could work just in the JSON-LD ecosystem. But what about all the people that are then converting to RDF? The way this thing works has to go all the way through the whole system. Otherwise, updates are not going to work, and people are going to have to program their applications to know about these special relationships between properties, no matter what, if they go all the way through to RDF. And if they have to know that, then I don't know what the feature is really saving them.
Okay, all right. So the proposal is to remove property generators from JSON-LD before last call due to no developers needing the feature. The feature being having a high potential of misuse. And because of the complexity, that's in specification. Okay, thank you, Paul, and thank you, Lynn, for the input on that. That definitely helped make the decision. And we can add it in later on if it's turns out that we really need it. I mean, the nice thing is that we know how to implement it now.
Well, there's always version 1.1, right?
Right. Yep, exactly. Okay. Thank you, Lynn, for joining us. Really appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome. Cheers.
Okay. Cheers. Issue 221, inverse properties in JSON-LD. There's a new feature that has been requested. I think that we have two people that have implemented it. It sounds like it's fairly simple implementation. I would also like to point out that we're supposed to be well past feature freeze, and we shouldn't be adding new features to the specification, even if they seem like they're very simple features to add. That said, what does the group feel about this inverse property feature in JSON-LD?
Well, you know what I want. I've been using it since 2011 or something. And currently at the National Library, I come across it all the time. The worry that we don't have it in place, because for instance, today we sat and extracted persons who are described like authors for books for which there exists no records right now, but we want to sort of reify their descriptions into separate documents, and then we want to record the link to the work that they've created, and that would be creator of. In the vocabularies we target, there aren't any declared properties for the creator of. And for instance, there is no such property in schema.org, and currently not in BibFrame, although it might turn up. But the principle is well, there are two problems. The one problem is that not all vocabularies define these, and a sub problem to that is that it's in certain areas or certain disciplines of using RDF frown upon declaring inverses of every property, because for different reasons you want to say how a property is primarily intended to be used. Regardless of that, it's in very many patterns clear how you want to use a certain property, even if there is an inverse. So when you in the way you create data, you naturally describe things as they occur over time and then link back to the things they originated from. For instance, you link a book to an author, and not, you don't always update the record of the author every time he writes a book and things like that. So there are many reasons around that. And another reason specific to this use case then is that you often want to, well, I can't generalize, but I have felt needs for representing links to objects. For instance, when I create JSON serializations of construct RDF Sparkle construct results, or concise bounded descriptions with describe, where I want to root the description in the primary object and then have many things linked to it which are linking to or from it, and then in this case indexing all in Elasticsearch to be able to filter works and authors and authors and works and so on. So there are many expressions where it feels natural to be able to say that in this specific JSON LD context, this term is the inverse of this actual term from a specific ontology.
Greg, you're on the queue.
I'm just curious if you have implemented the round-tripping bits of this.
In the code that I've used in the legal information system, because that's basically only compaction and custom compaction. It was a long time ago that I worked upon this part in the RDF lib-based code, so I think that I had something working for it, but I can't recall it. I think that when I designed it when I worked on Gluon, it seemed fairly simple to do round tripping, as long as you don't define the term as having both to and from. But in the legal information system, I've basically done, you know, the aggressive re-embedding approach, because I need to throw everything in Elasticsearch. So there I have another usage of it.
I did implement compaction as well, and it's quite trivial. Here's the link to my playground with an example. In that example, for example, children is actually the property parent, but it's the reverse of parent. So if you click and expand it, you will see that it expands to parent. And the compacted compacts back to children. It also takes into consideration if there is like an at reverse container already in the data.
Yeah, I really like that, because that it cleanly solves the two variants that I had when I suggested this previously. I've mainly use the reverse container approach, but in the simpler cases, for instance, in the National Library right now, we would like to be able to declare specific inverse or reverse properties as you have in the compacted example. So yeah. I would like to see this basically exactly the way you've implemented it.
Paul, you're on the queue.
Yes. We also have some use cases. One of the we're working on, we have to be able to support, obviously, kind of the inverse, being able to define the things. For us, we've had to work around, actually had to do a workaround to where we pull down the ontologies and do inferencing on the client side in order to be able to support, say, okay, well, is this the reverse, okay, or is this the inverse, or does this have, and pull those and do the inferencing actually on the client so it could understand what properties it needs to set. So it would be nice. We do have a way around, but it's one of those that it would be a nice to have. That said, I understand that we should be essentially feature complete like a long time ago, so that's definitely plays in. We have, we have a workaround that's barely adequate, but it will do us probably through at least our first release before we have to really start thinking about something else. Our first release is probably in a couple years, so.
Okay. So I guess the question is, would it be enough for us to create a description of how this should work and have people implement it as a kind of experimental feature, not included in JSON-LD 1.0, but basically all the implementations end up having the feature anyway. We could go that route, or the other route we could take is, since we have an implementation and Marcus is very capable of writing spec text in putting the, Marcus could basically put the algorithm in there exactly as he has it. But the one minor risk we run that way is that we end up standardizing a feature that doesn't necessarily work for everybody, because we don't have enough operational experience on this feature to just put it into the spec at the last minute before we go to last call.
I have a similar feeling to that, and I think that in general there's a lot of areas where we want to be able to expand on. For instance, I also have a need to be able to have sort of an ordered list variation on list.
Absolutely.
And which makes is much, much simpler for Sparkle, as anyone who's had to work with it knows, and also promotes open world types of specifications rather than RDF lists, which are closed world. And that's the type of thing which I think probably goes in a note or in some other CG type thing. Trying to solve everything and get it in after we've already passed the wire is just a recipe for disaster, I think. So I think we need to embrace sort of an open specification, if you will, and close the door on the JSON-LD 1.1 core, 1.0 core, in order to allow for things to use that as a basis for expansion. Then we can pick and choose among those in the future. As Nicholas or Marcus said, much easier to put something in later on than to take it out once it's already been put in.
My question is just, how long would it take for us to put it in later on? Because from my point of view, this isn't new in any aspect, as you know. So I think it's a very natural feature to have when you express graphs, directed graphs, as trees. Also, we have the BBC use case, which we didn't really go through, which was the restart of discussing this.
Well, I guess, Nicholas, would having the feature, I mean, in the processors and spec'd out fairly completely, but not in the JSON-LD 1.0 spec, address your concern? knowing that it's eventually going to be in there, or do you need it to be in JSON-LD 1.0?
No, I hope that it's enough. I also hope that it is enough for BBC. The follow-up question is, I mean, how many years would we see JSON-LD 1.1 appear?
I don't know if that's the right question. I think the right question is, in how many years would all of the implementations implement it in an interoperable way? And I think that would happen far before JSON-LD 1.1 would become a wreck. And at that point, it doesn't matter, you know. It's like it's there in the language people are using. It doesn't really matter if there's a spec if everyone implements it in an interoperable way.
Yeah.
Well, the difference is that your implementation is then not compliant anymore, because you don't drop properties which should be dropped because they don't expand to an IRI.
I think that's the problem. That's more of a core problem, that the spec is so restrictive that it prevents extensions from being added. And I don't think that was our intention, disallow that to happen.
And, I mean, I think the goal is still that the data should look like JSON, and in some instances it's really difficult to make that happen without a reverse, because you have to fall back to have an at graph and then an array which contains all the nodes, and since we don't have ID containers, you can't really access them directly, but you have to loop over that whole array to filter it and find the right entry to then finally get the other end of the link.
Could we do a straw poll really quickly to see who supports putting it in the spec before last call? Because I don't really know where we stand on that.
Before we do that, can we get an estimate on how long, since Marcus has implemented it, how long would it take you, Marcus, to put the text into the algorithms and update things?
It's a couple of lines. There are some special cases which you have to handle. For example, I disallowed that the property has both at ID and at reverse. So those checks to prevent such illegal context definitions, they are actually longer than the feature itself. So summed up, I would say it takes an afternoon to make it really solid in the specs.
And then remember, we also have to add the feature to the syntax spec before it goes in the last call.
Yeah, both specifications.
JSON-LD. Okay, so what's this feature called? Reverse inverse properties, JSON-LD inverse properties into the JSON-LD 1.0 specification as an at-risk feature. And then the other danger here is, it is we don't know if we're actually speccing something that's complete for folks. All right, so I think that's a resolution. Okay, so we have consensus to put the feature into the spec. Marcus, can you are going to be able to do that in the next week and a half?
I'm pretty busy until Sunday, but after that I will work on it. So probably it's ready till next Tuesday.
Okay. Next topic is issue 223. We have 7 minutes. Base versus at base. Marcus is asking, since we now have an at base keyword, should we also have a base argument that you can pass to the JSON-LD API? And I
my initial thought on this is, yeah, we can still have it, but at base in the document always overrides what the current base is set in the API. So the API sets the initial base, and then if you read an at base, that overrides the base set in the initial API call.
I'm a close one to what you just said.
Yeah.
Okay. So any Marcus thoughts?
What is that base in JSON-LD options actually used for? Is it also used in compaction, for example? I think it is.
Right, and I guess it would have the same. It would have the same effect, right? It would just be that's what the base is. Because in expanded form, I don't think we allow at base, do we?
No.
Yeah, so it would just be the base that you pass in would be the one that's used.
In my various serializers, if I pass base in to the serializer, then that would output, for instance, at base internal, and then use that for the expression of everything else. So I think that would be reasonable to be able to specify for either compaction or expansion.
You can do that by context if you would like that behavior, can't you?
Yeah, you can do it by context.
Yeah, it might be better to just keep it clean. Say,
yeah.
When you're compacting, put the at base in the context if that's what you want.
Yeah, it's just someone is writing a RDF serializer, which makes use of JSON-LD algorithms, which I have a wrapper that makes the JSON, two RDF be symmetric with the rest of the different serializations. If I were to pass that in there and I'm constructing a context where I'm, say, creating, I'm defining prefixes based upon passed in prefixes as I might with Turtle, in which case if I had base, I would put the base in the context, in the constructed context too. But I think for the purpose of the algorithms, that's not required.
Okay, so is this the correct proposal then? The base that's passed in via the API sets document base. Base in the document overrides any value set by base, which is passed in via the API.
I have a really quick addendum to that.
Sure.
Which is that I think we should support allowing the empty string to be specified for at base in the context so that you can indicate that there is no base, so that no changes would be made to URLs to normalize them or to change relative ones to absolute ones.
I often use something like that in order to allow things to be expressed using compact IRIs, using relative IRIs, even though it's not specified in there, which makes the document work if it is served from an appropriate location.
Right.
So this would
we have a similar use case. Oh, it would go against that?
Well, or maybe that I misunderstood perhaps what you were saying.
I'm saying if you specify an empty string, the output would use relative IRIs.
Okay, then I misunderstood. I thought you were saying
if the input was relative IRIs,
that it would be as if there was none, and you'd have to use absolute IRIs. That's not what you meant.
No. What I meant was no changes would be made during the algorithm to any of the IRIs that you put in. So if you put in relative, you would get out relative.
That sounds good, I think. I also misinterpreted it like Greg, I think, but that seems to clarify it for me.
Okay, so the proposal is allowed.
One more time, Dave, please.
If you use the empty string for at base in the context, what you're effectively saying is make no modifications to URLs. Don't try to normalize them. Don't try to change relative IRIs in any way. So if you have relative IRIs coming in, that's what you'll get out.
like where? Like in add ID?
Yes, in add ID.
Yes.
Okay, so the proposal is allow base to be set to the empty string. If base is set to the empty string, relative URLs won't be modified, won't be changed to absolute URLs, IRIs.
Yeah, it effectively just means don't change anything in add ID. Just treat it opaquely.
So effectively, any URL in add ID is processed as if it were an opaque value.
Just one quick question to make it clear. So if something like this here, it should be two dots. What should be the output? What should the output be?
The exact same thing. No, it doesn't process it at all.
Or should it be?
I think it should be the very first thing. No changes. If you specify the empty string for add base, make no changes to the input.
Because if you would process it like the third case there is suggesting, then you could just use the normal algorithm from the RFC and expand it against a relative IRI.
I guess you're assuming that you know what the IRI is in that case, Marcus, and you don't know the scheme. You don't know if you can do that type of normalization on the ID. Is that where you're coming from, Dave?
Sort of. I don't know if that argument holds, since we already make assumptions about that more or less any IRI scheme uses path-based
mm-hmm.
normalization. Also, real quickly, I wanted to make sure that this does not rule out using terms in add ID or anything like that either.
Well, I mean, if there is a slash, it's always a hierarchical IRI.
Is that true?
Yeah.
And it seems like my preference would be to do no processing on it at all, so that it's a way of people just saying, don't touch my IDs.
The reason why I'm asking is because I'm quite sure you could reuse the same IRI, the same library you're using to expand relative IRIs, but that just setting the base to that empty string, and it would resolve to that just hello.
I don't know. I think it depends on the library you're using. Some of them would not do anything.
Dave, one concern is that I don't know how standard this is. This type of behavior is. I don't know of very many other serialization formats that allow you to say "don't touch the IRI," meaning do path normalization on it.
I don't feel super strongly about that. I thought it would be easier to implement. But if the opposite is true, that's fine.
That's the only thing that makes me a bit uneasy about the proposal. Or the completely, the don't do path normalization on it. Marcus, I'm guessing that you had the same kind of uneasiness about it.
Yeah, perhaps if we just stay silent on it, it would work.
I'm pretty sure we'd need a test case on it. We want this to work in a specific way, one way or the other. So I don't think we should stay silent on it.
But let me do a quick check. Does someone know the RFC for number of URIs?
One thing to keep in mind is that if we do this sort of normalization, it will impact normalization algorithms. And if we want that to happen, then that's fine. But IRI normalization was not previously part of any sort of RDF normalization algorithm.
Well, we do IRI normalization.
Just dot removal is that sub-algorithm.
It presents problems, well, sort of for RDF, no more so than any other syntax that allows you to specify relative IRIs, though. When you go to normalize, if it's got to go to the RDF data model, they have to resolve to absolute IRIs in order to be valid within the data model. It's fine for the transitional serialization to leave them unresolved.
Dave, do you have any, So the main argument for not touching them is that it would be easier, and we're guaranteed. I guess there are two arguments. It would be easier, and two, we're not guaranteed. We're guaranteed to not foul up something that the developer meant to do. So maybe they did mean to have all of the dots in there, and then we go and remove them.
Yeah, I mean, as long as every tool that's operating on their data does the same thing, which is no good guarantee.
I'm on the fence on this. Does anyone feel strongly one way or the other?
Well, I just had a look at the URI algorithm, which defines how references are expanded to absolute IRIs, and if the base IRI is empty, everything that would happen is those dots would be removed. So it's that algorithm. I just pasted the link. So if you look at the algorithm, there's just that remove dots, which does exactly that. So it removes those dot dot slash things, and otherwise it just sets this base, or it sets the scheme to the basis scheme. If there is none, it's of course empty again, the authority the same, and so on. So we could just the base is an empty URI, and that algorithm, and just execute that algorithm as we do with all other relative IRI resolutions, expansions, whatever.
Yeah, so if we do what Dave was suggesting in the beginning, we would be deviating from the RFC 3986, which would probably not be a good thing.
Yeah, so true. I would suggest we support it, but stay silent on it.
Well, what I'm saying is that we can't stay silent on it. We have to say do dot segment normalization.
Well, we just say expand the relative IRI against the base, and the base is empty. So we don't have to describe that special case.
But that would do dot segment normalization, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So.
Okay, so we are telling them to do dot segment normalization.
Yeah, I don't think we're being silent. We're linking to the spec and saying, use this spec. That's fine, we can do that.
So the result of that thing I just pasted before would be that the result is dot dot slash hello instead of that middle two dots.
Yes.
Get rid of.
That's correct. Yep. And we should have a test case for that.
Yeah, we need to have a test case that puts lots of different kinds of relative URLs in there for MP base.
Okay, so allow base to be set to the empty string. If base is set to the empty string, relative IRIs are processed according to RFC 3986, section 552.
Yeah, but I mean, that's how they are always processed in JSON-LD, not just the empty string.
Right.
Okay, so that's a proposal. And Paul, plus one, minus one.
Yeah, I was just reading.
Okay.
I actually got an email from a colleague on something to ask at the end, so.
All right, that's the end of the call. Paul, you said you had something?
One of my colleagues was asking if on the jasonld.org spec latest site, here, let me just copy. Just from there, the diff to previous version link is completely broken and has been for quite a while.
Yeah, and it's probably always going to be broken. The only time the diff to previous version link works is when we create a static copy of the document.
Okay.
I think if you sit, let's see, let me see if this still works. You might be able to do Control-Alt, you see, do Shift-Control-Alt-S, and then you can click diff mark, and that might work. So that's Shift, Control, Alt, and S. But I don't know if the diff marker's up or down.
Yeah,
I don't know. It worked. But this is linking to a 30th September 2012 draft, so the previous version is incorrect. Or rather, it's the previous working draft we published, which was a very, very, very long time ago.
Okay.
The whole spec looks like a Christmas tree.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that's pretty much useless, though. All right, well, mark one eyeball it is.
Okay.
We're actually going back and fixing our APIs to be closer to the latest since it was implemented
a
while back.
You can manually create a diff mark between two versions of the spec, but you need two static copies. And there's a program called htmldiff.pl. It's a Perl script that'll diff two HTML documents. So you just need to get the latest one, hit Control-Alt-S, and then save as XHTML source, and then get whichever previous version you want, and then you do a diff between the two.
I think there's a W3C service that would do it, too.
Okay.
But any diff would be useless in this case because we rewrote all the algorithms.
Well, you just have to go to an earlier version where it's not quite so far off. So something that was close to the rewrite, which would show recent changes.
Okay. All right. Well, that was the only thing.
If you want the exact commands, just ask in IRC and we can give them to you.
That sounds good.
Okay. All right. That's the call for this week. Thanks, everyone. And we'll have another chat next week to go through the rest of the issues. Have a great week.
Thank you.
Bye.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks.